Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kolula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is your host with the most, Nikki Kolula. We're here with two of the three stars of a very awesome new indie film called Phoenix, Oregon. Mr. Jesse Borrego, James, I actually have your name as LeBros on my email, but it's LeGros?
LeGros, actually.
Okay,
LeGros. It's French, you know, the S is silent, but yeah.
Well, first of all, I watched the movie and I was so captivated from beginning to end. And I don't say that about a lot of movies. I was just telling Jesse before, there wasn't a weak link in the movie, from the cast to the story to the way it was shot. It was captivating. The dialogue moved. There were never any lulls. There were some cool twists. So let's start from the very beginning. How did you guys get wind of this project, or how did it all come together?
Why don't you go first, Jesse?
I reached Gary Lundgren, the incredible director, writer of this whole Phoenix, Oregon journey. Him and his wife, Annie Lundgren, they're Oregon filmmakers. And, the Oregon Film Office really supports their Oregon filmmakers. So these guys have been, applying their craft and their art, for over 20 years. They're originally from California, but they found a home and they were raising a family. But being filmmakers in Oregon. So they got together this incredible team. And James has worked with them before, and so has Dietrich. And so they got a chance to experience kind of this Oregon film vibe. A friend of mine named Peter Bratt, another independent filmmaker, is a friend of theirs, and he called me and said, look, there's these filmmakers, the Lundgrens. There's this great script. You should in this film. So when I got the script, at that time they were still trying to figure out who the cast was, but I knew that James was playing the lead. And I was a fan of James's work, having kind of known of each other's work throughout the years. And so I was excited, and I said, if he's the lead and I'm able to do something with this character. And again, like you said, once I read the script, actors, we're always looking for something to sink our teeth into. Right. And that makes us feel good. Many times we have to make our audition and our work choices based on what's hot, zombies, superheroes, whatever. And, especially as a Latino actor, I'm always getting the negative stereotypes and characters. So a lot of times, it's a little bit of this, a little bit of that. So when I find something like this, it really kind of excited me. Carlos, he's, he's proud of his culture, but he's not your typical, Latino character that they write for American cinema with an accent and with an immigrant background. And none of that was important to the story other than background for the character. The true narrative was about these friends, these brothers, and truly about how, our protagonist, Bobby, is dealing with the same thing that everyone else in the script is doing. And the whole theme is about a dream deferred, is about that idea of inevitability that we get to at a certain age, where did you let a couple of things go by? Did you let a couple of those pitches that you should have swung at? And so you start to then get a bit of a desperation in your life. And I think both of these guys at the beginning of the film are going through this, but more so our lead character, where you actually get to see what his dreams deferred were. And I think that was kind of what I vibed on, was being able to be a part of that narrative. And again, knowing what I know about James's work and what he was going to do, at my age, you know, I want to be able to look back and say, I'm glad I was part of that. And so I think it was a no-brainer for me. So once I talked to Gary and got his take on what Carlos was and what the film was, I got really excited. And then the next step was actually getting to Oregon and realizing, you know, James had already shot about a week's worth of stuff. And the incredible thing about, again, brother, I hate to blow a lot of smoke up your body, but it's the truth. I was really impressed. Again, his character arc, he had to basically do the internal journey a week before the other actors got there. Hey, yo!
Dietrich made it! How are you, man?
Brother.
Good, man. Hold on, let me turn up the volume.
I know him.
You must have been busy.
And that was another reason. Knowing that I was going to be working with these guys really attracted me to the project. So all of that, you know, was what really, again, attracted me to what it was.
Well, it was super cool. What was super cool, there was like a common thread between each of the characters that they were all like either burned out or hopeful or reaching for a dream at some different stage.
Bird, man.
And that you guys all bounced off each other, and the great
film.
I mean, an ensemble is like how you kind of draw chemistry and energy from. And all three of you guys, you know, you guys drove the story in different acts or different scenes. So that's what made it so captivating and so awesome. I was laughing sometimes, and then I was like, you know, going through the roller coaster of emotions with each of your characters. And all of you guys had different character arcs, but each of your characters had, you know, the yin and yang of the, you know, the triumph and the despair parts. And that's what made it so powerful. It was, there wasn't one character you couldn't relate to. So that's what I loved. Did you guys all know each other before this project or not at all?
Well, James and I have known each other for an incredibly long period of time, like 33, 32 years.
Wow.
Yeah, long time.
Yeah. And had any of you worked together before? James, did you and Dietrich work together before?
Funny enough, no. Wow. This is our first picture. We might have we been in something that we were both in, but we didn't work together? Is that possible?
No. No, I wish, but no. I'd love to be in my new gun, for example. That would have been great. But no, no. I've always wanted to be in a movie with James, and that was really cool for me. Yeah, that was a big deal.
And you know, all of you guys, the cool thing about this film too, I've seen all of you in other projects.
Right.
To see how you guys all depicted your characters, and they were a little bit different from, you know, other characters. Dietrich, you've always played these extreme, ridiculous characters, and you always own it. But what the cool thing was, each of you kind of complimented each other on that spectrum of, you know, being, you know, hopeful and trying, you know, to reach for something that was maybe just out of your grasp on some level.
Yeah. I was really psyched to be with everybody. Jesse and I, this was our first picture together, first of many, I hope. Lisa Edelstein and I have known each other for decades as well.
He was great too.
And worked together on multiple things. I don't know. We probably worked together 4, 5, 6 times. Kevin Corrigan, I think I've worked with maybe 7 times.
I think 8. Wow. Yeah. 7 maybe or 8. Eight,
apparently.
He was so pissed. He's like, that's it. It's either 7 or 8. I'm out of here.
I'm walking off. I'm changing my lighting. Sorry.
I've known you 30 years. I've worked with you 0 times. Kevin Corrigan's worked with you 7, 8 times.
Well, I come from the music world, and the three things everybody always says, it's like, if you can get 2 of the 3, if the money's right and the project's right and the hang is great, then all three things make it the most incredible project ever. And it just seemed like everybody was having a good time working on this. But let's talk about the nitty gritty. What were some obstacles you guys went through, either in the process of shooting or when you guys were just figuring out your characters? Maybe each of you have a different obstacle you went through going through this process.
Well, you know, anytime you make a movie at this price point, every day is loaded with obstacles. You never really have enough time to complete everything that's on the shot list of the day. I mean, maybe you do, but many times you have to sacrifice things or refigure things in a more economical way. So that's just the general hardship of it all. But I like what you said about the how things line up on what determines a good gig. And I think in the movie business and the TV business, it's similar that way. Like, what are you doing? Who are you doing it with? And where are you doing it?
Yeah, absolutely.
And 2 out of 3 ain't bad.
2 out of 3 ain't bad.
Well, you know what? This is one of those movies that's a slow burn. You can tell, when people hear about this movie, they'll watch it and get the same response because, man, and you guys couldn't have picked a better time for people to take in a movie. If there's any good time, a world pandemic is a perfect time to watch.
That was luck, man. That was luck, serendipity, and, a lot of good vibes that I think paid off. Because like you're talking about, once we got on the project, and I tell this story a lot, but as time went on in the shooting, and I saw who our cast was, and I saw as an actor, the pressure's on Gary and Annie to get this thing done. So they're in producer director mode. I can tell that James is in the zone, man. So he's trying to make sure that as he leads this film, it's watchable. The rest of us are having fun. Because I really felt like there was no pressure on me whatsoever other than to have fun and be true to the character, be true to the work every single day. And I could just tell that Diedrich, Lisa, all of us, Kevin, we were all experiencing that same thing. Now, I was there for a couple of weeks. Diedrich was there for, a week. A
couple of bites.
And I was just amazed.
Right? And you went away and then you came back, right?
Him, Ray Gallegos,
I didn't come back.
Kevin, they just came in and the work that they did and the art that they did in such a short amount of time. I just kept telling Gary, I go, man, when you leave this thing alone for a while and go back to it in the editing room, start to put together your film, you're going to see that these people have brought you their gold, their stuff.
Well, Diedrich couldn't stay long. He's got all those books to read behind him, man.
That's right. I know. Yeah. Sorry I was late, by the way. We were watching Invasion of the Body Snatchers, the first one. Wow. I totally got drawn in and I forgot.
Happens to the best of us.
Come on. It's a great movie.
Where's Diedrich? Really, he's on his way. Obviously, they know you well. They're like, he'll show up.
No. I'm good for that, but I just,
probably
yeah.
In the bathroom.
Well, it was like Sam Peckinpah apparently is in the movie somewhere, and I was really, this is the third time I've seen the movie. The first time I noticed that Sam Peckinpah was in the cast, and I was like, wait a minute, where's Sam Peckinpah?
He must have been young, huh?
Yeah, I had to be young, but I didn't see him, so that was a little disappointing. So here I am, though. Anyway.
Diedrich, usually your characters are a little bit, they're like the sidekick, the friend.
Yeah.
The obnoxious guy, but not to the point where it's like mean. Maybe Rex Kwan was borderline there. But for this role, you had to be a dick sometimes. Like, how was that with people that you actually respected? Like, were you able to tap into an old boss from your, previous years, or what was that? What was the inspiration behind that?
I had a boss when I worked at a restaurant in Old Town Alexandria, where I'm from, who was passive aggressive and really awful and mocked you constantly. And I only worked there for 2 weeks. And once I got my first paycheck, I quit.
You're like, that's it.
No, I'm out. Yeah. I've actually only done straight jobs. Every straight job I've done have been exactly 2 weeks. The first paycheck.
That's it.
You're I'm like, the worst. My dad was so worried about me.
It's a two week itch.
So like the first check comes out, I'm like, that's it? Really? For all that? Feels like not enough. But I mean, what's nice about it is that when you're able to play such an awful person with people that you respect, like Jesse and somebody that I've known as long as James, they know I'm not that person. I don't have to constantly go, I'm not an actual awful guy.
Yeah. You know what? I got to say, though, part of what I liked about that character, though, is you know, he's this guy, you know, he has this manner that I guess could be off-putting, you know, whatever. I imagine he thinks, you know, look, you're going to make a omelet, you got to break some eggs, you know, or whatever justification he... But then you find out, you know, he's kind of not in any different boat than the rest of us. Right. He's just trying to keep his business alive. The margin is thin.
Yeah,
the room for error is small. And that's another thing I like about this story is it speaks to people who are just trying to make it Monday to Sunday.
Right.
You know, however best they can, which describes most of us.
Now, James, your character was kind of very brooding and it was intense because I could tell there were, you know, battles, inner demons that your character was battling. Right. How did you kind of sort through that, or what was your, you know, what was your muse to kind of deal with just a brooding character throughout to show, like, you know, it was never, you never made it look like I'm the victim. You made it look powerful, like there was this kind of like layered part of the mind that you were going through. What were you kind of, you know, thinking?
Well, I mean, honestly, I was just kind of working with what was on the page and what I, where I thought the script was telling me to go. And certainly, you know, with Gary's direction, of course. But that character isn't really much like how I am personally. But honestly, I just kind of like let the script sort of take you like the wind and I don't really worry about it. One thing I've learned over the years as an actor, I never plan anything. You know, I kind of sort of figure out the rhythm of the character and, you know, obviously, you know, prepare my lines and all that, but I plan nothing.
Well, it definitely had like a hero's journey kind of vibe because you're rooting for him because you know, like he's already gone through anguish and heartbreak and, you know, he's got regrets and you see right. This, you know, him going through these, you know, different obstacles to right. Get to that promised land.
Well, ultimately he has to slay the dragon that resides within himself. So I suppose.
Well, I like the revenge you got on Diedrich's character. We won't go into it without revealing too much, but there's a good little, there's moments where you're like, yes, okay. There's some resolve, you know?
I have to say one of my favorite moments that James does in this movie, and I really like the picture, is before he dives into his own comic book, to his own artwork, James took a nice moment where he was like, am I going to dive in? And then he dove in, and it was a very well done.
Thanks, Dietrich. Thank you.
Yeah. Now, I have a quick question about the comic book side of it. You, James, you were like sketching on some of the comic book, you know, drawings.
Sure.
Were you trying your best not to mess it up, or do you have any kind of artistic ability that you can
very little of any kind. You know, almost got tossed from the kindergarten class and I cheated when I drew a circle pulling a knife. So marginal at best. But you know, we had great artwork and you know, I think sometimes when you're in a movie, you just kind of like go with it. And I suppose I'm lucky in that at this point, if I make mistakes, I don't really care. That's somebody else's problem to clean up.
That's why they edit.
That's what an editor
is. That's kind of like the goal of an artist, though. You know, it's like leaving the mistakes in. Miles Davis used to say that on records. It's like, if there's not a mistake on there, I don't want to hear it. So right. Sometimes those things become... Like right.
That was a really cool documentary I saw about him on PBS not that long ago.
The Birth of Cool, man. The Birth of Cool.
Yeah.
Jesse, out of the three of you, who's the best bowler?
James. I mean, dude, the fact that they were actually Dietrich?
No. I'm saying James is. Yeah. I don't know James, what kind of pretty bunch configuration we're in, but I'm pointing to James.
You gotta go like that.
Oh, right there.
Yeah, there you go.
You're that way.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that he actually had to bowl strikes on camera, I was so impressed. And, you know, that's the beautiful thing about working with independent filmmakers is you're gonna go, even though, like James said, every single day is a budgetary challenge and you're gonna let some things go. Some shots you wanna take, you know, some chances that you want to play with just because you're trying to make your days. So one of these I thought was the throwing of the strike. I thought, well, you know, they're going to let him throw a couple. if it doesn't nail it, we got to get in and out of here, so they're going to cut. But yeah. I saw that they were going to go for it, that they had made, you know, characters.
Yeah, we had a shot designed, and sometimes I could throw them.
Yeah.
I just got on a run where I was just like, split, spare, one. Couldn't, I just couldn't.
Dude, come on, I couldn't.
I must have like thrown like 40 times.
You know what I'm saying? And they, but the commitment, brother, the commitment to do it and to toss every single toss, knowing that that's going to be the keeper. That's beautiful. And I was there with him, because in one of the shots, I had to be right there with him cheering him on. And so I couldn't fake it after 10 times and go, well, he's not going to throw. You know, I had to be right there with him. And it just really inspired me, you know, kind of, you know what I mean? You're on the court and you're seeing your Magic Jordan go for it, your Michael Jordan go for it, that you want to be that Scottie Pippen. You're like, all right, I'm here for you, man. When it's my turn, I'm going to do the same thing.
And you
so
said,
I think that inspiration just kept building.
You said you can't cook pizzas like your character, but did you learn anything new about cooking pizzas that you didn't know from making this movie?
Well, you know, the first thing I thought was, you know, I got to learn how to toss. And then right away, he was like, no, Napoletan style is not toss. It's smaller pieces. It's a different type of crust. The main thing was figuring out, he kept sending me YouTube videos. The director, Gary Lenovich, kept sending me YouTube videos about how they spread the dough. It's a very particular flip of the wrist. And like James said, you know, actors, we're good at BSing, you know, so, but at that, you know, we're also perfectionists. So for me, I wanted to really master it. And so I kept looking at these videos and I just couldn't get it. And so flying on the way over there, I kept going over the scenes in my head, and the one that kept bugging me was the one that had nothing to do with anyone else. It wasn't even a scene. It was just me pretending like I could spread the dough, and I was panicking on it. I kept going, why can't I get it? You know, you go through that moment. And at that moment, I had that realization that we have as professionals. You idiot. You don't have to learn how to make pizza. You just have to look like you know how you're making pizza. Hello? I've got a degree in this. So at that point, I just kind of, like James said, you know, you make a fucking mistake. Come
well,
on,
I thought
man.
You
Gary's
looked like
cover you, baby.
A total pro.
Yeah.
Once, I really thought you pulled it off completely.
And now, you know, that's the team ball, because I told Gary, this is my stress. So the minute we did the first take of that and he came over and settled me down and said, bro, exactly that. You look like a pro. Now it goes out of your head and you have fun and you get the takes that they need. You know, but as actors, you go through this stuff anytime you're dealing with something.
Yeah, it's part of it. Yeah.
Part of it, you know, and that's what's fun, because you really do learn things, you know, and that's probably why people think that I probably could cook a pizza.
Can I ask a question? Diedrich, what was the hardest job that you did where you had to, like, produce some skill?
Probably, what was it called? Quantum Leap. Riding a motorcycle with a suicide clutch.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. Suicide clutch was only made for 2 years for the obvious reason that most people died.
The name.
I was supposed to be like the Marlon Brando role. Like, he went into the 1950s. And anyway, I rode the motorcycle as much as I could. And I rejected that particular motorcycle because I'd ridden a bunch of motorcycles in DC. But they all had regular clutches, and a suicide clutch is extremely difficult. And I rolled it out, and the executive producer decided that he liked the look of the motorcycle. And so this is a true story. I've actually never told this story in an interview. But I had this one particular ride. It was very, very difficult to ride. And I had a girl on the back, Josie Bassett, who ended up being on Melrose.
That's right.
Right. Lovely actress. Great to work with and very pretty. I had this one bit where we were in the hills above Malibu. I had to ride uphill, which is, of course, with any stick shift, it's difficult to do. But with suicide clutch, it's almost impossible. And then ride by like this little cliff part and skid out a little bit and then turn around and then ride away.
Oh my God. I did it
three times. And, the director said, I want you to do it one more time. And I said, I'm not going to do it. And the it got very quiet. And I said, he goes, come on, just one more time. And I went, no, I did it three times. If you don't have the shot, that's not my fault. It's your fault. And he goes, look, I'm just saying one more time. I go, you can have a stuntman do it and a stunt person for Josie, but I'm not doing it. And he goes, come on. It was James Whitmore's son, James Whitmore Jr. And he goes, just one more time. And the DP was like, come on, we don't have our stuntman. And I go, yeah, I'm not going to do it.
Yeah.
And it was a really big drag at the time. And then the guy, you're not going to believe this part. The guy that was the wrangler for the motorcycles, long, like gray hair with a braid and the whole braided beard and the thing and the, he was fantastic. I mean, he was the exact like guy that you want to give you shit. But anyway, he comes up, he gets on the suicide clutch, gets in the exact position. And, cause it was a very big deal. And he goes, watch this pussy. Revved it up. Revved it up, drove it off the cliff.
Oh my God, really? That's crazy.
Oops. It was like out of a cartoon. He goes, shoop, boom. Like that.
Wow. You're like, I saw that on Bugs Bunny once for sure.
Disappeared. And Josie Pesette, under her breath, beautiful gal, turns to me and goes, thank you. That's how hard it is to ride this motorcycle.
That's a wrap.
Let's talk about the screenplay for a second. Screenplay is very well written. What was it about either your character or just the screenplay as a whole that drew you to this project? We'll start with you, James. We'll go to Jesse and we'll go to Dietrich.
Well, you know, I like the story, you know, of underdog and somebody fighting through whatever personal demons. All those elements were compelling to me, the idea that there was going to be an animation arm of the story as well. But mostly the main reason is the relationship I had with Gary and Annie. I had worked with them previously and I just liked them. And that frequently that just dictates my decisions and why I've worked with several filmmakers over and over, just because I found the experience pleasurable.
No one wants to work with an asshole. I can understand that.
Well, you know, I mean, it's tough.
I've been on that
all day long. You know, you're really busting your behind. If you're going to be in the trenches, you want to be there with somebody you like or and trust. You know, and I have to say, just those are two of the most decent, just ethical people I've ever come across in my, you know, 39 years in show business. They're very special in terms of just what they bring as human beings. You know, their morale code, their ethics, their compassion for the people that work for them. They're just great people. And, you know, and then smart and talented and all the rest of that, of course.
What about you, Jesse?
The script for me, really, I loved the Latino characters and the fact that they were represented in such a wonderful way, without being patronized. And so that drew me to it because I knew what I could put into it. And then all the themes that James was talking about, the themes of a dream deferred, the themes of this middle age crisis, and knowing, like I said, that, what I could do with this ensemble of actors. And so I think that, but that's what draws me to the project. Not only are we going to have fun, but is it going to be something that I'm going to be proud of to say, oh my God, this is something that I've worked on. And this is one of those. So
good
writing, Gary.
DJ, what about you?
Well, I had worked with Gary before, Gary and Annie, and I completely agree with everything that James said. They are lovely people. And that's very rare in show business to meet somebody that you genuinely like and think is lovely. I liked the script all the way through. My part, I wasn't incredibly attracted to my part, but I wanted to be a part of this larger thing. I really loved two real elements to it. I love the middle-aged romance that James and Lisa had. Once I knew Lisa was attached, I have to say
that was a more attractive.
Yeah, that was a good.
We weren't sure if we were going to get her.
Yeah, and once I learned that she and James, because like as James pointed out, they had worked together before. They have a real chemistry, and she's a really wonderful actress, and that kind of changed. Did. And the other thing that really attracted me was, Jesse alluded to it earlier, was, this is going to sound strange coming from a guy named Diedrich Bader, but the way that Latino culture was represented was so beautiful and so positive, so organic to the story without saying, like, look at us! Look at this amazing thing that we do! At the same time, it was just beautiful, like the embrace of the culture, the family. It's hard to put it perfectly, but the idea of a culture like a village and like people really being together, it's really apart from my own culture, which is basically you're on your own. That's true of the WASP culture, of the German culture. It's like, you know, good luck. But with the Latin culture, it's really like you're in a community. And I thought that was represented in a way, I mean, Gary obviously is not a Latin, but I thought it was represented in a way that was really organic and beautiful. And one of my main attractions to the script, and I thought realized in a way that I was very happy with.
Yeah. Great answers, man.
Yeah.
I would agree with that. One thing I would just add to that is that what I also like, he didn't draw a circle around it. You know?
Yeah.
It just lived and breathed in its own sort of like rhythm and time. And he didn't need to get out a highlighter and have arrows pointing at, you know.
That's a sensitive writer, which Gary is. But also that's a tribute to who he is as an artist, because that is a lot of that influence comes from the kid who played my nephew, Rudy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
He's Louis G. He's the other producer. Yeah. Well, their relationship, you can tell that Louis's got that family. He's got that Mexican-American family, and they've embraced Gary in their friendship, and he kind of drew on all of that, kind of made parallels in his own life, and was able to infuse all of that into this character, just, you know, just to flesh out Carlos's character, to flesh out this narrative. But it just, you know, again, it's just this beautiful stew that you put together when the flavor comes out.
And well, there's something that's really cool too, that's subtle. It's like, you know, they show this, you know, Hispanic Latino family, but Carlos's character is drawn to another culture.
Yeah, Italian food.
Yeah. So like just that like acceptance or that level of like admiring another culture while also showcasing that culture and melding all the cultures together. It just was awesome.
Absolutely. Great point. That was one of the things I really loved about it, was that he didn't just embrace his own culture. Right. He embraced another culture. Right. So
which
it's like
what we should be doing.
Yeah. You know what I'm saying? It's like, it's so simple, but it has yet to be expressed really in movies. And I thought that was beautiful.
Sensitive writing, man. Beautiful writing.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the marketplace right now is super crazy. It's like the wild, wild west, you know?
We were number one.
Oh, that's awesome. I didn't know that. Really?
Yeah.
That's amazing. Wow.
Yeah.
It's a fluke. I'm taking it. I'm taking it, James.
That's right, baby. Yeah. Like the Spurs asterisk season, man. We're taking it.
No, there's a big asterisk right there, but I'm taking it.
Whatever. Yeah, no, we did win the weekend. That is
That's what I'm saying.
That's all that matters. That's all that matters. Use it as leverage for, you know, promotion. Oh. That's all it takes.
Number one movie.
Let me ask you this: as each of you, as actors, what was the you know, biggest inspiration for you to become actors and, you know, want to just, you know, pursue the craft? Because, you know, one of the reasons I love doing this show, like, I'm a musician, I've been an artist my whole life, and I love hearing about people's processes or what made them want to become the artist that they are.
Oh, that's easy. It was the first thing I was any good at. I was terrible at everything. It was the only thing I was ever good at.
High school or something? What was it?
You know, I kind of started doing plays when I was, I think, maybe a junior or senior in high school. And then, you know, I went away to college, sort of, really to smoke dope. And,
That's acting school, man.
I don't know. You know, and there was this girl that I liked, and she auditioned for something, and I thought, well, maybe I ought to do that, too. So, and I ended up getting the job, and she didn't.
Ooh.
Sort of, I don't know, the romance didn't really go anywhere, but... You know, I just is the only thing I was any good at. And, and I got lucky early and kind of just stayed lucky. So I never had to really face reality.
He's super modest. He's being incredibly modest. James is ridiculous.
And I have the tape to prove it. I got couple episodes of The Knight Rider and Punky Brewster and Simon and Simon.
Sure.
You know, right?
Punky Brewster was my favorite fucking show.
You like singing and dancing and after school specials.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Same.
All right. And they didn't want you to be good either.
Yeah. And Jesse, hello, has been around forever.
Oh my God. He was huge. It was like way above my pay grade. I aspired to get to where he was.
That's what I'm saying.
Many years.
We may have been a popular show, but fame was syndicated, dude. When I would hang out with the network stars and I told them what I got as a salary, they would laugh at us. They'd sit there and go, what's wrong with you guys? Yeah, we were the first show to be produced in syndication, but that means that our, we had no network salary whatsoever. We were a canceled show that was in syndication. But it was really popular, so it gave me, like James said, man, I was an overnight television star. And so I got a chance to experience all of that. The main thing for me, though, that drew me to being an actor was the chance to play with people like this. So I'm amazed whenever I finish a touch of interviews and I walk away and I realize that we've all been talking and that we've done something together that can be seen. And then I see you guys on TV or I see you guys on the latest show that's streaming. And I feel so blessed to still be having fun doing what I chose, like James said, when I was young, when I was just playing around, when I was just trying to feed my ego. And more than anything, I was just enjoying myself. I grew up with a father who was an accomplished accordion musician.
Yeah, I saw that in your bio.
Cool.
In the Tex-Mex style. And so, as a matter of fact, he just gave me a bunch of 78s. Can you believe it? Does anybody have a 78 player? Those were before. Really? Need it. And right on top, he goes, see if these have any value. Right on top was a 78 that he recorded.
Oh, wow.
It says, right, yes, with his first group. I said, Dad, this is yours. But, you know, that type, that's what I grew up with. I grew up with him as a recording artist. I saw him performing the Tex-Mex music, which is bilingual, which is bicultural. So that was a natural part of me growing up as a kid. So when I got into school, you know, my sister was in theater, she was in sports, so I got into it too, and I was her dance partner. So I did it just through osmosis and just by having a family that was kind of artistic and performers like that. And then when I graduated high school, I had nothing. I was a loser. I didn't have grades enough to go to college or so I was going to join the military. And then a local Catholic college had just built a brand new theater. And so they were trying to recruit young students, specifically Chicano students, because they didn't have enough Chicano students. So even though I didn't have the grades, my friend, who was an upperclassman, was going to school there, and he put my name in the kitty. So they called me, and even though I didn't have the grades, and at that time I qualified for all the financial aid, because my parents went around. So with Pell Grants, I actually got into college and studied theater.
Wow.
And hung around long enough to, you know, write my plane. And that's when I got bit. And that's when I realized, like, James, this is the only thing I'm good at. What else am I good at?
Right.
What else am I good at? And it actually got me into college. And so at that point, I realized that this is what I wanted to do. And so I stuck with it. And I stayed in the education, higher education, because I realized that was somewhere that I could study my craft and still be safe. So rather than jumping into trying to be a professional, I hung around for 5 years in the higher education realm and did school plays, started theater companies, did all kinds
of stuff. Oh, wow.
Eventually made my way to California Institute of the Arts, that has a great theater program, especially in the 80s.
My sax player went to that school. Great school.
Oh, yeah. They had a great music school, art school. They were all around. But at that time, there was a young group of us. I went to school with Don Cheadle.
That's fancy.
Yeah, we were the classmen at that time. We were very multicultural at that time. So we all kind of entered the business in the late 80s at about the same time. And at that time, they were starting to do films that had a bit more of a multicultural feel. You know, they were doing Colors and La Bamba and doing all of that. So having gone into television, it was easy then to transition into doing films. But I never lost my love of the theater. So every time, I mean, I remember the very first time we went on hiatus after my first television season, everybody went on vacation. I went right back to doing theater. Everybody said, what are you doing? We're going to take a break. And I said, no. You know, theater's where I've just been doing a year's worth of television, man. I'm not going to do some theater. And I think that kept my juices flowing in terms of not letting my craft get stale. But it also kept me in love with wanting to make sure that in my career I chose the projects that were going to make me proud. So it hasn't made me rich, but I can tell you, I've looked back at my career, and Phoenix, Oregon is one of those high points where I can truly say, not only did I love working on the project, but now, and that's the serendipitous thing about what happened with the pivot, is what I've experienced, and I know you guys have probably experienced this with other independent films, you have these wonderful experiences. You make films quite possibly with people when you have a cast like this, and I've done several independents that had casts like this, ensembles, strong leads, great stories, and you have all of this wonderful production, but then you get into the horrible world of independent distribution. And in the 90s, when there was kind of an independent cinema movement, all those independent distribution companies got bought out by the majors.
Right.
And in the late 90s, in the last 15, 20 years, it's been very difficult to make an independent film, much less get a good theatrical, and then somehow or other get a good deal to go into DVD, you know, which was the last 15, 20 years, and now into streaming. So we were kind of...
What was your first movie? What was your first job?
My first...
Your first gig. Yeah, what was your first gig?
Fame.
That was your first job?
I was at CalArts, and they had an open call for new kids because Bill Blinn was leading the show, and they kind of wanted to do like a gimmick. So they had a American Idol type of audition where thousands auditioned off the streets in New York. I auditioned at MGM with about 3,000 people on a weekend. And you know, they chose Janet Jackson, Mia Peoples, who already had an agent.
Right, right.
I was the only person who got chosen out of that open audition.
Wow, so, out of that open freaking cattle call.
Yeah,
that
from one night to the next.
That is an impressive achievement.
And it was a triple threat. It was a triple threat audition because we didn't act. We didn't audition. We had to sing and dance first.
Wow. Right.
So I was auditioning against the best dancers in L.A., the best singers in L.A. at that time. I mean, but Madonna was at the audition.
Wow.
Everybody wanted to be on the show. It was a hot, very popular show at that time, especially for performers. You know, I mean, Janet. It's a no-brainer.
In the world of dance, Debbie Allen's like one of the greatest names in
dance. Oh, my God, yeah. Legend status. Mm-hmm. What about you, Diedrich? What did you start out with?
What got you into acting? What was that moment that made you want to become an actor?
It's hard to sound unpretentious telling the story. We moved to Paris when I was a kid, and when I was really little. I just learned English, basically, and then everybody was speaking French around me. I got really obsessed with silent movie performers and those that were silent when they performed, like Harpo Marx. But I was particularly obsessed with Charlie Chaplin.
Oh yeah, he's the best.
Oh my God, yeah, wow.
Particularly obsessed with him. So I went as often as I possibly could, and When I was about five, I had worked up a Charlie Chaplin act in my... James, I never told you the story before.
I don't... If you did, you might have, and I could have forgot. That happens to me now.
All right. World. So my fake aunt, Audrey Schur, took me to my favorite theater in Paris. And it was my favorite theater because they had a live organ accompaniment.
Wow.
And I loved the... I love somebody playing along with Charlie Chaplin because it was different every time. Although Chaplin did release a score for every movie that he did, it was a loose thing. You could improvise as much as you wanted. You could also just completely improvise. This guy was particularly great. And the film got caught and burned. and the audience booed. They booed. And my thought was...
Nailed.
Nobody boos Charlie Chaplin. So I jumped up, ran down to the in between the audience and the screen, and I did my little Charlie Chaplin act.
No! Wow! That's amazing.
True story.
And the organ player played. Paris, France.
That's right. And the organ player played, and I finished my bit. I did a little roll, you know, at the end, doffed my pantomime hat, and that was pretty much it.
Dude, that's incredible. How old?
An origin story.
How old were you when you did that?
I was five.
Wow. I mean, you know what?
Yeah, but the chutzpah.
Well, you know I've got that.
Now you got chutz. Now you got some chutz in your pa.
Yeah.
Dietrich, I have to ask you, you played a lot of iconic characters. What is your favorite line or character that you've played outside of this movie?
Outside of this movie, because you knew I was going to spin it to this, be this movie.
Great movie. It's a great movie.
I don't know if I have a favorite, honestly. I, like most actors, I just move forward. I don't tend to look back too much. I don't know. I mean, I'm very happy with Office Space. I think I'm...
that's such a good movie.
Classic.
I'm happy with it. I think it holds up, even though it's a very, very much of a period piece. I think it holds up. I love the surreal quality of Napoleon Dynamite.
That's another great picture.
Wow. Of the films I've done, those are probably my favorite. I've done some studio pictures that I've never really been happy with. And I didn't really see the point when I was shooting them. And I was talked into it by my agent. I'm just being completely honest right now. I was talked into it. Every feature film that I did for a major studio that was a big picture, I was talked into, and I didn't care for, and I didn't like shooting, and I wondered why I was there, and I enjoy television infinitely more than doing a feature film on a studio level, because I just get bored really easily, like 60 takes of a script I'm not crazy about. I'm like, after three, I'm like, nah, feel like I'm done.
I get that. Yeah. Let's talk about the movie now. So once the movie was finished and you got, did you see it in a film festival together? Did you get an advanced copy? Like, what was your reaction when you first saw the completed film as it is?
I think they sent me I was working on something and they sent me a link. So I couldn't, I wasn't available to see it anymore. You know, it's just.
What was your reaction? Did you kind of.
Oh, I was really pleased. I was
Were you happy with it?
I mean, just sort of at that very base level, I'm always relieved when it isn't awful. I'm just like, oh, thank God.
Yeah. Here you
know, because quite frankly, you know, I'll tell you a quick story. I had a meeting with Miloš Forman about a movie that never really got made. It was on when MGM was still the MGM lot.
Okay.
And my agent tells me, bring a picture and a resume. Like, you never really get asked that because I always get sent to the casting director and they may have a stack of those to look at. But for some reason, you had to bring your own picture and resume. And so I go to his office, which was actually now close to where the Sony offices are, in this little tiny office that his desk took up a third of it. No sign-in, no assistant. I open the door. He's at the desk. I walk in. Hello, Mr. Foreman. I hand him my resume. We never have eye contact. Uh-huh. He looks at the picture. He flips it over. He looks at the resume. He says to me, "That is an accident report," and hands it back to me. It is not a resume. That is an accident report. Meeting over.
Wow. Did you read? You didn't even read.
Meeting over.
Wow.
That sucks.
What did he mean?
It happens.
This is not a resume. This is an accident.
That's not a report.
You know, James, I saw it at the Ashland Independent Film Festival with an audience. Diedrich, was that the first time you saw it too?
Yes, I was there. I was just remembering. Yes.
That's the way to see it. That was the way to see it for the first time. He wanted to send me, Gary wanted to send me a screener, and I said, no, I want to wait, and I want to see it on the big screen with an audience. And that was the best audience to see it with. One, they were appreciative of it, right? And two, it just really, to me, that's when I really knew we really had something. And I knew Gary had put together the film that he wanted. And like I said, I could see everything that we brought to it. But I just, at that point, I was really, really so in love with your performance. Everybody's in general. I mean, the music, all of it.
I agree.
And I just really loved what you did with Bobby, and I thought that
thanks,
to
man.
Me was what was going to carry it all the way through.
I agree. That was a great crowd to see it with. And what was lovely was the crowd following James's character screwing up. Like, they really, like a Hitchcock film, they would gasp because they knew he was making a terrible mistake. Right. And I really loved that. They were on board 100%.
On board. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's the reaction I think you get from this movie. It pulls you in. And once it pulls you in from the beginning, you're in it all the way. And you're going through the ups and downs, and you're seeing the different conflicts and obstacles of each character. So I can totally imagine a full packed house at a film festival loving this and engaging with the characters. So that
even when you look at what the other actors were able to do with their characters, I mean, again, Ray Gallegos comes in. Oh, yeah. And he's playing.
Yeah, Ray was great.
He was great.
Yeah. But he comes in and he just makes this. I mean, you really do love this guy.
Right.
You want him to be legitimate, man. He just makes him so charming. And you understand how Lisa's character, how Tanya was taken in. When you see what Lisa did with this character, the same thing. She comes in and she just makes this strong, beautiful character that's got just this hint of vulnerability that's just enough, man, to make her part of this narrative like all of us. And you see that she too has a dream deferred, that she too has gone through some tragedy. And again, it's all about how do we deal with that point in our life when we've seen more over there than over here. And what is the point then? I think every character's going through that, but every actor was able to tap into their own personal journey and represent it for that particular thing, for that particular.
I think the strongest thing about the movie is every character wins and loses,
Yeah.
There aren't a lot of movies where you see this kind of breadth of winning and losing on a very unpredictable scale. So Every character kind of has their own wins and losses, and it kind of, you see how the world works. It's like, it's not going to be on your timetable. It's not going to be when you want it or when you think the redemption is, but sooner or later you'll have to figure it out and things will land where they're supposed to be.
And that's what's the allowance of that for a director to be sensitive enough to let his actors figure that out. And that's why I kept telling him, I go, look, dude, right now you're half in director mode trying to make your shot list with the amount of time you got left, and I can already see you as an executive producer going, am I going to make my shot list? But trust me when I tell you that the takes that you're getting, that what Kevin's giving you, what James is giving you, what Dietrich's giving you, what me and Lisa are giving you, even what your Oregon actors, I mean, there was a lot of people from the local talent pool that just came in and did brilliant jobs, just wonderful, sensitive work in the moment, in the vibe of it all. And I just kept telling Gary, I go, watch, when you get back and you're going to be able to look at this as a director/editor, you're going to see, and you're going to be able to put together the film that you want. Because that's what we do as actors. We make real living three-dimensional characters. You talk about a character like Kyle, which on, you know, could very easily be a stereotypical character. Right. But the humanity that you brought to him, we could play with that. So later on, when he shows up in our bowling story, it makes sense that he's there. You know, it's not like, oh, he was the bad guy in Act One, so he shouldn't be in Act. No, he can be there. We can eat pizzas together. We can still not trust him. And then you see where Diedrich then, as the actor, is able to show you the humanity. When he, man, it's so wonderfully pathetic when you're at that you're at the pinball machine. Dude. Yeah, it's such a wonderful.
He's screwing the pinball machine. Yeah.
Yes, but that's what Kyle's going through. That's his interview, man. That's his little moment.
I want to give a shout out to a part that probably could have been really cliched. Although I will say Gary wrote a really good, he writes women really well, but I think Lisa did an amazing job.
She was amazing.
Totally.
And she was part of the ensemble in a way that, you know, it brought it together. I think the movie couldn't have been driving without her because she was connected to every character in some way, either directly or indirectly. You know,
the picture would not have a heart without Lisa. And she was disappointed in James's character and then dismissed him. And then it was over. And then it was not over. And it was beautiful because the greatest thing that humans can do is forgive one another. And I thought that was portrayed perfectly. And Lisa did a fantastic job with it. She's a lovely, lovely actress. And
there was tension and release in those scenes too. So yeah, I totally agree. You were saying something, Diedrich. I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No. I said everything. I really think Lisa is an underestimated actress. I really feel that way. I agree.
I think she'd be,
she's also a hell of a director and a hell of a writer. I've worked with Lisa on a lot of different levels over the years and with her doing multiple things. And she's just a powerhouse all the way around.
Yes, she really is. She's a creative force. James did a short film with her that we actually watched. When we, you know, because you're on location, it's the social life is what it is. So we went over to her house and we watched the film, and of course James is amazing in it, but Lisa's direction is great, and she's a really creative force and a beautiful person. Like her soul is beautiful, and she's able to show us that on screen, which is a rare commodity. That's all I wanted to say.
Yeah, that's awesome. Jesse, I see you got one of the bowling pins from the film, I assume. Did you take any memento from this movie or any other movies that you've done in the past that you treasure?
Did I take any from the film other than the clap? Nothing.
No, I don't have anything. I don't think. No, I don't have anything.
Did you get a bowling pin?
No, I don't need anything. I've got it all right here.
yeah. No, I mean, I feel like we've done our bit and that's what we leave behind.
Actually, some years ago, I had a complete sort of like break from showbiz sentimentality. Like I gave away my surfboard from Point Break. I threw away all my old scripts. I just got rid of all of it. Gave it away.
Wyoming, I don't need
anything. We go through that, right? I still regret throwing away about like two boxes worth of Fame scripts. And now I'm like, I could be slanging those right now. Ah, okay, memorabilia, never mind. But yeah, you know, after a while you accumulate stuff and you're like, let's move on, man. Let's go on to the next thing. Yep.
I will say, you know, this is another story and maybe a little long, but the reason I got into show business was that I was going to be a stage actor and I was on vacation in Santa Fe, New Mexico. And great town. By hook or by crook, like I met a casting director at a dinner party. Anyway, I ended up getting cast in a pilot in a Western, which was really great. I dressed as a cowboy every day. I rode a horse. I had guns. It was really fun. Anybody who says that they didn't have a good time doing a Western is a liar. I worked with this old actor named Lee DeBro, And he took a shine to me for some reason. I was like 20 years old or whatever. And he goes, what are you up to tonight, Bader? And I go, well, I'm going to go see a Chinatown. And he goes, really? Chinatown? And I go, yeah. And he goes, have you seen it before? And I said, no, I've never seen it. It's the first time. And he goes, big screen? And I go, yeah, yeah, big screen down in the, do you want to go? And he goes, and I was like, that's a strange thing to do. That wasn't a yes or a no. It was a, is that kind of some sort of actor like gesture or something like that?
Was a gesture anyway, from the thing and also something that happened in the movie.
It happened in the movie because Jack Nicholson's character gets his nose cut, right?
Yeah, by Roman Polanski.
Right. And then he complains to the cops. He's got stitches in his nose. There's a cop that walks by him, does this gesture about his cut nose.
It was him.
It's Lita Bro.
Wow.
And I guess because I was...
Not always.
I mean, we could say I was 20 years old. It was a long time ago. I guess because I was so incredibly stoned at the moment, it hit me so profoundly that here's this guy, years and years and years and years later, who does the smallest gesture to me, and he knows it's in amber. It's in amber. It will live
forever.
Well, that's like some of those great, you know, lines, you know, that from movies that, you know.
They'll live forever. And that's what draws you in. Like, you're a stage actor. Before that, I wanted to be a stage actor. I was like, oh, this is the thing. But that's smoke, and which is beautiful to watch. It's curling and it's gorgeous, and but it goes away.
Yeah.
One thing that's like great about this film, it's got story. I mean, I'm always looking for the story in whatever art I'm consuming, whether it's a movie or if it's music or if it's going to see a painting. And this film has such a riveting story. And the power of the story, I think, is showcasing how each of your characters show restraint in how you kind of harness that energy to kind of keep it breathing. And I think that's what makes movies live forever, when they become this living, breathing thing that kind of stands the test of time that you can always come back to. I still watch Goonies all the time because it's that same thing. It's like, how could you not love this movie or Back to the Future? It's like great movies you want to watch over and over and over again. And I actually had that feeling from this movie because there's so much bullshit. Like I need art that inspires. That's, I think, all of us do as artists. We want to watch something, we want to hear something, we want to feel something, because that's what makes us want to create. And this film, you know, I was like, okay, let's check this out. From beginning to end, each of your performances, it resonates in how the story moves. In, you know, as a last question, in one word, how would each of you define this movie for you? It could be about the experience, it could be about the story, or how you felt making this movie, but one word that kind of encapsulates your experience or your interpretation of this film.
Oh, wow. Delicious.
Yeah.
Did you say, what did you say? Did you say ambitious?
Delicious.
Delicious. Good. That's
delicious.
Good.
Delicious.
James?
Everybody likes a comeback.
Good.
Yeah, I would say redemption.
Yeah,
that's the word I was thinking.
Well, you went to college, see?
Yeah, I didn't. I went to art school.
Now you're being pretentious.
No, but I would say redemption. I would say redemption. I mean, he had a chance, he blew it, and then he got it back.
And you know, in this marketplace, like, there's so many ways to kind of like market a film, or you know, what's your kind of hope for this movie? How do you want people to see it? You know, watching it on their phones, watching it in their living rooms, like, how do you want this movie consumed? Because people want that experience. They want to know how it should be ingested. And here's your one chance to kind of tell your audience, watch this in this capacity.
I just hope that a picture like this, people will see some part of themselves within these stories. You know, right now we have a lot of people who are really carrying us through a really difficult time, who, I'm going to tell you, a year ago, there were other people thinking, oh, they're not worth $15 an hour.
Right.
Everybody making that argument now.
That's right. God bless.
I would say, you know, that's the audience I hope to reach. And those are the people I hope can see something of themselves in these characters.
Terrific answer. What about you, Dietrich and Jesse?
I think, however, whatever medium you see it on, you see it on your phone, you see it on your computer, you see it at home. As James said, it's like, do you want to read the hardback or do you want a paperback? It really doesn't matter. The story needs to be told because it's a very human story. And it's not about superheroes. It's not about Tony Stark and his billions. It really is about human beings and how fallible we are and how capable we are of redemption and love. And it's a beautiful story. It's a very human story. So however it's told, really, it could be told, you know, they could whisper it to each other by the fire and I would be happy.
Good answer.
The audio book is next.
You know what? That's a way that people consume, though, you know?
Although, you know, the soundtrack, they could really put out that soundtrack, that musical soundtrack. What's the guy's name that did it? John?
Oh, yeah. Who did his other movie?
He's an Oregon guy. The soundtrack is incredible. Not only is it the right dramatic flavor for everything that's going on.
John Askew.
Just the rhythm, everything is about rhythm, you know, especially as an actor. I'm a mover, I'm a dancer, I like rhythm. And I really thought that it never got in the way, that there was a rhythm and a pacing to the film that I think the soundtrack helped. But I also thought that the music was very entertaining. I love listening to, the soundtrack for Last Temptation of Christ.
Oh, that's beautiful. Yeah.
Peter Gabriel. So I love listening to sound, you know, 100 across 110th Street. Remember that old street movie? That's a great soundtrack. So I love soundtracks.
You know what's also really great, too, is the inspiration for the soundtrack of Last Temptation. Oh, wait, what am I thinking of? The not Last Temptation of Christ, the one with De Niro where he goes and he goes to South America.
Mission.
Oh, Mission.
Yeah.
That's a great, the soundtrack that's the inspiration for the soundtrack is really great.
Wow.
The reason I ask, it's like I'm in the middle of making a record and I'm recording it on analog tape. And the craziest thing is you see generations, like they want to show you music on a cell phone. And it's like, man, you go through this process where it's like filmed right. And it's like everything and the audio, everything looks right. It feels right. The performances are there. And then you watch it on a cell phone or an iPad. It's just not the same experience. I mean, I was watching it in my music room with a, 4K screen and nice speakers, and that made the experience more personal for me because
that's the double-edged sword. The double-edged sword, and exactly in, addressing your question, two things are happening. One, because of the fact that we've had to pivot to getting to our audience because we were trying to have a theatrical release, and we kind of jumped a checker there. The ability then is to be able to get it to our audience, which is on a smaller screen. They're having to watch it. I have a lot of friends that went, well, can I watch it on my TV? And I'm like, well, yeah, if you've got a smart TV, if you've got an old school way of watching TV, then you have to watch it on your laptop. You have to watch it on your device. So everything's about the technology of compression, right? That's what you're talking about. Compressing this information so that it comes out digitally. So I would say that absorb it. Go to phoenixoregonmovie.com because right now we're splitting the revenue with these theaters that are being shuttered and with these different groups that are holding these online screenings, right? We did one with ARP. We did one with the independent film festivals. So we're going to continue to do these event screenings. But you can also help the filmmakers and help the theaters that have been shuttered, the independent cinematic theaters, by watching it now. However, I would still say that I would love to go back to doing some sort of a retro run at the big screen theaters. And I would urge anyone who has that type of a home theater system to watch it blown up, because that's how I watched it. And I love watching movies like that. And I still think that if you've got those capabilities, you've got a big screen to watch it like that with a home theater and really enjoy it that way. So between those two ways of watching it, you know, watch it on your device, man, download it, watch it, enjoy it with us, get it right now. But at some point, I think we're going to be actually having DVDs and Blu-rays, and they're going to be actually streaming in another way. And I hope, like I said, that after this is all over, we can go back to having some sort of another run at the theaters, big screens.
And like I said earlier,
it's possible.
After all this, you know, passes, I'd like to have you guys come back when it's re-released, or if it's re-released, even if it's a Blu-ray release. We'll talk more in depth about the movie. I want to end the interview by just thanking you guys for making this picture, because, you know, when this pandemic happened, the funny and ironic thing about all of this is the one thing that people have been turning to more than anything has been art. And the fact that you made such a tremendous movie is something that people need to see this movie for, because it's got heart. It's got redemption. It's got all the things that, you know, I think people need more than anything, and that's hope. So thank you guys for making this.
Awesome. Thanks.
And at $6.50 a ticket, why not? At $6.50 a ticket.
That's right. That's right. So download this movie, watch it. We'll do another interview with you guys again in the studio. I appreciate you guys doing this interview virtually. And just, you know, just leave the listeners and viewers with one little last pitch from each of you as to why you think they should see the movie. Go ahead, Jesse. We'll start with you.
If you love good cinema and you love good stories, come watch Phoenix, Oregon.
James?
Oh, let's face it. You've got nothing better to do.
Very good. Diedrich?
I would urge anyone that that wants to hear a story that's outside of the normal Hollywood trope to defy their expectations and to get very close to reading a book, which is watching Phoenix, Oregon. It's a beautiful film. It's very small. It's easy to enjoy, great performances, and a beautiful redemptive story. I recommend it.
Well, thank you guys. That's a terrific way to end this interview. I hope to see you guys in the future. I hope to see you guys working again together. And I love this movie. I really did.
Thanks.
So thank you guys so much.
Bye, my friends.
See you guys.
Love you guys. All
right, guys. Take care.
Thanks.
Take care.
That was chill, right?
Yeah, it's